all accessible now to those with the right foresight. The first to grab the rights and lock up the resources would be the one to prosper, Goyette had said. The big American oil companies and mining conglomerates had already been expanding their influence in the region. Goyette could never hope to compete head-to-head. But if they were removed from the playing field, it was a different picture. Goyette could monopolize vast chunks of Arctic resources, setting himself up for billions in profits. That would be a bigger payoff than the ruthenium, Zack thought. But he might well score on both fronts. Finding the mineral without interference was almost assured. Eliminating the American competition from future exploration was well within reach. Goyette would owe him, and owe him big. With a content look on his face, Zack stared back at the passing ice and casually waited for the Royal Geographical Society Islands to draw closer. Part 3. Northern Pursuit. Chapter 57. For a few brief weeks in late summer, Canada's Arctic archipelago resembles the Painted Desert. Receding snow and ice lays bare a desolate beauty hidden beneath the frozen landscape. The rocky, treeless terrain is frequently laden with startling streaks of gold, red, and purple. Lichens, ferns, and a surprising diversity of flowers, fighting to absorb the waning summer sunlight, bloom with added bouquets of color. Hare, musk oxen, and birds are found in great numbers, softening the cold aura of morbidity. A richly diverse wildlife, in fact, thrives in the intense summer months, only to vanish during the long, dark days of winter. For the rest of the year, the islands are a forbidding collection of ice-covered hills edged by rock-strewn shorelines, an empty, barren landscape that for centuries has drawn men like a magnet, some in search of destiny, others in search of themselves. Staring out the bridge at a ribbon of sea ice clinging to the tumbled shoreline of Victoria Island, Pitt could not help but think it was one of the loneliest places he had ever seen. Pitt stepped to the chart table, where Giordino was studying a large map of Victoria Strait. The stocky Italian pointed to an empty patch of water east of Victoria Island. "We're less than 50 miles from King William Island," he said. "What are your thoughts on a search grid?" Pitt pulled up a stool, then sat down and studied the chart. The pear-shaped landmass of King William Island appeared due east of them. Pitt took a pencil and marked an X at a point 15 miles northwest of the island's upper tip. "This is where the Erebus and Terror were officially abandoned," he said. Giordino noted a sense of disinterest in Pitt's voice. "But that's not where you think they sank?" he asked. "No," Pitt replied. "The Inuit account, though vague, seemed to indicate that the Erebus was farther south. Before I left Washington, I had some folks in the climatology department do some modeling for me. They attempted to recreate the weather conditions in April 1848, when the ships were abandoned, and predict the potential behavior of the sea ice." "So the ice just didn't melt, and the ships dropped to the bottom where X marks the spot?" "It's possible, but not likely." Pitt pointed to a large body of water north of King William called Larsen's Strait. "The winter freeze propels the pack ice in a moving train from the northeast, down Larsen's Strait. If the sea ice off King William didn't melt in the summer of 1848, which the climatologists suggest, then the ships would have been pushed south during the winter freeze of 1849. They might have been reboarded by a small party of survivors, we just don't know. But it is consistent with the Inuit record." "Swell. A moving target," Giordino said. "Doesn't make for a compact search zone." Pitt drew his finger down the western shore of King William Island, stopping at a conglomeration of islands located 20 miles off the southwest coast. "My theory is that these islands here, the Royal Geographical Society Islands, acted as a rampart against the southerly moving ice pack. That rock pile probably diverted some of the ice flow, while breaking up a good deal more piling up on its northern shore." "That is a pretty direct path from your ex," Giordino noted. "That's the presumption. No telling how far the ships actually moved before falling through the ice. But I'd like to start with a 10-mile grid just above these islands and then move north if we come up empty.
Sounds like a good bet, Giordino agreed.
Let's just hope they drop to the bottom in one piece so they'll give us a nice, clean sonar image. He looked at his watch.
I'd better rouse Jack and get the AUV prepped before we get on site.
We've got two aboard, so we can lay out two separate grids and search them simultaneously.
While Pitt laid out the coordinates for a pair of adjoining search grids, Giordino and Dahlgren prepared the AUVs for launching. The acronym stood for Autonomous Underwater Vehicles. Self-propelled devices that were shaped like torpedoes, the AUVs contained sonar and other sensing devices which allowed them to electronically map the seafloor. Pre-programmed to systematically scan a designated search grid, they would cruise a few meters above the seabed at nearly 10 knots, adjusting to the changing contours as they ran. As he passed just north of the Royal and Geographical Islands, Captain Stenseth slowed the Narwhal as they entered the first of Pitt's search grids. A floating transponder was dropped off the stern, then the ship raced to the opposite corner of the grid where a second buoy was released. Keyed to the orbiting GPS satellites, the transponders provided underwater navigation reference points for the roving AUVs to keep on course. On the stern of the ship, Pitt helped Giordino and Dahlgren download the search plan into the first AUV's processor, then watched as a crane hoisted the large yellow fish over the side. With its small propeller spinning, the AUV was released from its cradle. The device shot forward and quickly dived beneath the dark rolling waters. Guided by the bobbing transponders, the AUV scooted to its starting point, then began weaving back and forth, scanning the bottom with its electronic eyes. With the first vehicle safely released, Stenseth piloted the ship north to the second grid area and repeated the process. A biting wind cut through the men on the deck as they released the second AUV, and they hurried to the warmth of the nearby operations center. A seated technician already had both search grids displayed on an overhead screen with visual representations of both AUVs and the transponders. Pitt slipped out of his parka as he eyed several columns of numbers quickly updating on the side of the screen.
Both AUVs are at depth and running true, he said. Nice work, gentlemen.
They're out of our hands now, Giordino replied. Looks like it will take about 12 hours for the fish to run their course before surfacing.
Once we get them back aboard, it won't take long to download the data and swap batteries. Then we can set them loose again on the next two grids, Dahlgren noted.
Giordino raised his brows while Pitt shot him a withering look.
What did I say? He asked in a bewildered tone.
On this ship, Pitt replied, a razor-sharp grin crossing his face. The first time's the charm.
Chapter 58. 60 miles to the west, the Otoc churned through the wind-whipped waters on a direct path to the Royal and Geographical Society Islands. In the wheelhouse, Zack studied a satellite image of the islands through a magnifying glass. Two large islands dominated the chain, West Island, separated by a thin channel from the smaller East Island. The Mid-America mining operation was located on the southern coast of the West Island, facing Queen Maud Gulf. Zack could make out two buildings and a long pier in the photograph, as well as evidence of an open-pit mine nearby.
A message came in for you.
The Otoc's unshaven captain approached and handed Zack a slip of paper. Opening it up, Zack read the contents.
Pitt arrived Tuktoyaktuk from D.C. early Saturday. Boarded Numa research vessel Narwhal, departed 1600, presumed destination Alaska. M.G.
Alaska, he said aloud.
They can't very well go anywhere else now, can they? He added with a smile.
Everything all right?
Yes, just a tardy effort by the competition.
What's our approach to the islands? The captain asked, peering over Zack's shoulder.
The south coast of West Island. We'll make for the mining operation first. Let's run right up to the pier and see if anyone is home.
It's early in the season, so they may not have opened up summer operations yet.
Might be a good place to dump our captives.
Zack gazed out the aft window, watching the barge tailing behind wallow in the turbulent seas.
No, he replied after contemplation. They should be quite comfortable where they are.
Comfortable was hardly the sentiment that came to Rick Roman's mind, but under the circumstances, he had to admit they had made the best of things. The cold steel deck and bulkheads of their floating prison quickly sapped their efforts to keep warm, but a solution lay in the debris left behind. Roman organized the men under penlight and had them attack the mound of tires. First, a layer of the old rubber was laid on the deck. Then a series of walls were built up, creating a smaller den where all the men could still fit. The mooring ropes were then unwound and draped over the tire walls and floor, creating an extra layer of insulation, as well as padding for the men to lie on. Huddled into the tight enclave, the men's combined body heat gradually forced a rise in the temperature. After several hours, Roman flashed his light on a bottle of water at his feet and noted an inch or two of water sloshed atop the frozen contents. The insulated den had warmed above freezing, he noted with some satisfaction. It was the only satisfaction he had received in some time. When Murdoch and Bjorkes returned after a two-hour inspection of the barge's interior, the news was all bleak. Murdoch had found no other potential exit points astern of their storage hold, save for the cavernous holds themselves. The mammoth overhead hatch covers might as well have been welded shut for the chance they had at moving them. "I did find this," Bjorkes said, holding up a small wood-handled claw hammer. "Somebody must have dropped it in the hold and didn't bother to retrieve it." "Even a sledgehammer wouldn't do us a lot of good on that hatch," Roman replied. Undeterred, Bjorkes began attacking the locked hatch lever with the small tool. Soon, the tap-tap-tap of the pounding hammer became a constant accompaniment to the creaking sounds of the moving barge. Men lined up to have a go at the hammer, mostly out of boredom, or in an attempt to warm themselves from the exertion. Against the incessant rapping, Murdoch's voice suddenly raised over the din. "The tow ship is slowing." "Cease the hammering," Roman ordered. Ahead of them, they could hear the engines of the icebreaker slow their deep-throated drone. A few minutes later, the engines dropped to an idle, then the barge bumped against a stationary object. Listening in silence, the men anxiously hoped that their frozen imprisonment was over. Chapter 59. The Royal Geographical Society islands appeared as a mass of buff-colored hills rising above the choppy slate waters. The islands were christened by explorer Roald Amundsen in 1905, during his epic voyage on the Jo, when he became the first man to successfully navigate the length of the Northwest Passage. Remote and forgotten for over a century, the islands remained a footnote until a freelance exploration company found an exposed deposit of zinc on West Island and sold its claims to Mid-America. The Mid-America mining camp was built on a wide cove along the island's rugged southern coast, which zigzagged with numerous inlets and lagoons. A naturally formed deep-water channel allowed large ships to access the cove, providing that the sea ice had vanished for the season. The company had built a 300-foot semi-floating dock that stretched from the cove, sitting empty and alone amid the chunks of ice bobbing in the surrounding waters. Zack had the captain pull to the dock while he scanned the shoreline through a pair of binoculars. He viewed a pair of prefabricated buildings perched beneath a small bluff alongside a gravel road that ran inland a short distance. The windows of the buildings were dark, and piles of drifting snow could be seen accumulated in the doorways. Satisfied that the facility was still abandoned from the winter shutdown, he had the Otok tie up to the dock.
"Have the team of geologists assembled and put ashore," Zack instructed the captain. "I want to know the mineral content of the ore they are extracting here, as well as the geology of the general area." "I believe the team is anxious to get ashore," the captain quipped, having seen a number of the geologists suffering from seasickness in the galley.
"Captain, I had a large package sent to the ship before I arrived. Did you receive a delivery in Tuktoyaktuk?"
"Yes, a crate was taken aboard there.
I had it placed in the forward hold. Please have it delivered to my cabin. It contains some materials that I'll need on shore, he said.
I'll have it taken care of right away. What about our captives on the barge?
They're probably near death, he said, eyeing a digital thermometer on the console that indicated the outside temperature was 5 degrees.
Ah, yes. Our frozen Americans.
I'm sure their disappearance has a few people excited by now, Zack said with an arrogant tone. Toss them some food and blankets, I suppose. It may still do for us to keep them alive.
While the geologists made their way ashore, accompanied by an armed security team, Zack stepped down to his cabin. His package, a metal-skinned trunk toting a heavy padlock, sat waiting for him on the carpeted floor. Inside was a carefully organized array of fuses and detonators, along with enough dynamite to flatten a city block. Zack selected a few of the items and placed them in a small satchel, then relocked the trunk. Slipping into a heavy parka, he made his way to the main deck and was about to step off the ship when a crewman stopped him.
You have a call on the bridge. The captain asks that you come right away.
Zack took a companionway to the bridge, where he found the captain talking on a secure satellite telephone.
Yes, he's right here, the captain said, then turned and handed the phone to Zack.
The testy voice of Mitchell Goyette blared through the earpiece.
Zack, the captain tells me that you were tied up at the Mid-America facility.
That's right. They haven't initiated their summer operations yet, so the place is empty. I was just on my way to make sure they stay out of commission for the season.
Excellent.
The way things are heating up in Ottawa, I doubt an American would even be able to set foot up there.
Goyette's greed began to chime in.
Try not to destroy any infrastructure that might be useful for me when I purchase the lot at a fire sale price, he said with a snort.
I'll keep that in mind, Zack replied.
Tell me, what have you learned about the ruthenium?
The geologists are just now making an initial survey around the mining camp, but we're presently on the south side of the island, and the trader's map indicated that the Inuit mine was located on the north coast. We'll reposition there in a few hours.
Very well. Keep me apprised.
There is something you should be aware of, Zack replied, dropping the bombshell. We have the American crew of the Polar Dawn in our captivity.
You what? Goyette howled, forcing Zack to pull the receiver away from his ear.
The industrialist's temper burned white-hot, even after Zack described the circumstances of the abduction.
No wonder the politicians are going ballistic, he hissed. You're about to set off World War III.
It makes it a sure thing that the Americans won't have access to this region for a long time, Zack argued.
That may be true. But I won't enjoy profiting from their absence if I'm sitting in a jail cell.
Dispose of the matter, and without incidents, he barked.
Whatever you do, there had better be no link to me.
Zack hung up the phone as the line went dead. Just another unimaginative thug who had bullied his way to billions, Zack thought. Then he slipped his parka back on and went ashore.
A brown ring of rock and gravel encircled the island's cove, melding into a white sheet of ice as one moved inland. The exception was a large rectangular rut that ran several hundred feet into the hillside, ending in a flat, vertical wall clearly cut by machine. The zinc mining operation was simply cutting straight into the landscape, where the mineral-rich ore was readily accessible. In the distance, Zack noticed a few of the geologists poking around the tailings of the most recent diggings. The interior of the cove was protected from the worst of the westerly winds, but Zack still moved quickly down the dock, not wishing to prolong his exposure to the cold. He quickly sized up the mining operation before him, which was simple and low-tech. The larger of two buildings was a warehouse that housed the mining equipment, bulldozers, backhoes, and a dump truck, that dug up the island's soil and transferred it onto a small conveyor system for shipboard loading. A smaller building next door would be the crew's bunkhouse and administrative office. Zack made his way to the smaller building first, curiously finding that the door had been locked. Pulling a Glock automatic from his pocket, he fired twice at the deadbolt, then kicked the door open. The interior was like an expansive house, with two large bedrooms filled with bunk beds, plus an oversized kitchen, a dining room, and a living area. Zack walked directly to the kitchen and looked at the stove, which trailed a gas line to a storage closet containing a large tank of propane. Digging into his satchel, he removed a charge of dynamite and placed it beneath the tank, then affixed a blasting cap with a timed fuse. Checking his watch, he set the fuse to ignite in 90 minutes, then exited the building. He walked to the equipment storage building, studying its exterior for some time before hiking around to the backside. Towering over the building was a small bluff, which was strewn with ice-covered rocks and boulders. He struggled up the steep slope to a slight ledge that ran horizontally across the upper face of the hill. Kicking a divot in the frozen ground beneath a car-sized boulder, he removed his gloves and placed another charge of dynamite under the rock. With his fingers freezing, he quickly set the fuse to the blasting cap. Moving a few yards away, he set a second charge beneath a similar clump of large boulders. Scampering down the hillside, he returned to the front of the building and set one more charge by the hinge of a large swinging door. Setting the fuse, he quickly stepped back to the dock and headed for the icebreaker. As he approached the ship, he could see the captain peering down at him from the bridge. Zack pumped his arm, motioning for him to blow the ship's horn. A second later, two deafening blasts echoed off the hills, signaling the geologists to return to the ship. Zack turned to see that the geologists took note of the message, then he walked to the barge at the end of the pier. The dock just reached to the bow of the barge, and Zack waited until the current nudged the vessel against the pylons before jumping onto an embedded steel ladder that rose to the vessel's deck. Climbing up, he made his way astern, passing the number 4 hold on the way to an indented well on the aft side. Kneeling against an exterior bulkhead, he packed his remaining explosives, this time affixing a radio-controlled detonator. It wasn't positioned beneath the waterline as he would have liked, but he knew it would do the job in the rolling seas that they had been encountering. Ignoring the lives of the men huddled a few feet away, Zack stepped off the barge with a wry sense of satisfaction. Goyette wasn't going to be happy losing a newly built barge, but what could he say? Zack's instructions were to leave no evidence, and disposing of the barge where nobody could find it was the perfect solution. The last of the geologists and security guards were climbing aboard the icebreaker when Zack reached the gangplank. He headed straight to the bridge, thankful to enter its warm interior.
"Everyone is back aboard," the captain reported. "Are you ready to leave, or did you wish to speak to the geologists first?"
"They can brief me on the way. I'm anxious to investigate the North Shore." He looked at his watch. "Though we might want to enjoy the show before shoving off."
2 minutes later, the bunkhouse kitchen blew up, leveling the walls of the entire structure. The propane tank, which was nearly full of gas, exploded in a massive fireball that sent waves of orange flame skyward, its concussion rattling the windows on the ship. A few seconds later, the storage building charge went off, blowing off the front door and crumbling the roof. The hillside charges were next, creating a tumbling landslide of rocks and boulders that poured onto the mangled roof. When a thick cloud of airborne dust finally settled, Zack could see that the entire building was pulverized under a layer of rock and rubble.
"Very effective," mumbled the captain. "I guess we don't need to worry about an American presence in the vicinity now."
"Quite," Zack replied in a tone of arrogant certainty. Chapter 60 The westerly winds whipped across Victoria Strait, kicking up white caps that washed over the sporadic chunks of floating ice. Forging through the dark waters, the bright turquoise Numa ship appeared like a beacon in a colorless world. With the Royal Geographical Society islands visible off its bow, the ship steamed slowly south into the first of Pitt's search grids.
"Looks to be a vessel rounding the northwest coast," the helmsman reported, eyeing the radar scope.
Captain Stenseth picked up a pair of binoculars and viewed a tandem pair of dots on the horizon.
"Probably an Asian freighter making an escorted attempt through the passage," he said.
He turned to Pitt, who was seated at the chart table studying a blueprint of the Franklin ships.
We'll be approaching the finish line shortly. Any idea when your torpedo will pop up?
Pitt glanced at his orange-faced Doxa dive watch. She ought to surface within the next half hour. It proved to be 20 minutes later when one of the crewmen spotted the yellow AUV bobbing to the surface. Stenseth maneuvered the ship alongside, and the AUV was quickly hoisted aboard. Giordino removed its 1 terabyte hard drive and hustled the data to a small viewing room, where a computer and projection system awaited.
You headed to the movies? Stenseth asked as Pitt stood up and stretched.
Yes, the first of 2 rather long double features. You have a fix on the transponders?
Stenseth nodded.
We'll go grab them next. They've actually been pushed quite far along due to the strong southerly current here. We'll have to make a bit of a dash for them before they pile up on the island rocks.
I'll tell Dahlgren to be standing by, Pitt replied.
Then we can go grab fish number 2. Pitt made his way down to the darkened viewing room, where Giordino already had the sonar's collected data displayed on the screen. A gold-colored image of the seafloor was scrolling by, revealing a largely flat but rocky bottom.
A nice, crisp image, Pitt said, taking a seat next to Giordino.
We boosted the frequency for a higher resolution, Giordino explained.
He handed Pitt a bowl of microwave popcorn.
But it still ain't Casablanca, I'm afraid.
That's okay. As long as we find something worth playing again, Sam.
The 2 men sat back and stared at the screen as an endless swath of sea bottom began scrolling by. Chapter 61 The Zodiac pounded over the choppy swells, careening off small chunks of ice as a freezing mist sprayed into the air. The pilot kept the throttle open until approaching a wide expanse of unbroken ice that stretched from the shoreline. Finding a section with a sloping front edge, he drove the inflatable boat up and onto the sea ice. The hardened hull of the Zodiac slid several feet before mashing to a halt against a low knoll. Seated near the stern, Zack waited for the geology team to exit the boat before he stepped out, following a guard carrying a hunting rifle whose sole job was to ward off any inquisitive bears.
Pick us up a mile down the coast in exactly 2 hours, Zack ordered the pilot, waving an arm to the west.
Then he helped shove the Zodiac back into the water and watched as the rubber boat sped to the Otak, idling a half mile away. Zack could have stayed in the warmth of his cabin, reading a biography of Wild Bill Hickok that he had brought along, but he feared the geologists would dawdle in the cold. What actually drove him ashore, he didn't want to admit, was the disappointment he felt with their geological assessment of the Mid-America mining camp. While it was hardly a surprise when they confirmed the rich ground content of zinc and iron on the south side of the island, he had expected that some trace elements of ruthenium might be present. But none were found. The geologists, in fact, found no evidence of any platinum-related elements in the exposed stratum.
It meant nothing, he assured himself, since he knew exactly where the ruthenium would be found.
Digging into the pocket of his parka, he pulled out the journal pages that he had stolen from the miners' co-op. In heavy charcoal was a hand-drawn circular diagram that clearly resembled West Island. A small X was marked on the northern shore of the island. At the top of the page, a different hand had written Royal Geographical Society Islands with a quill pen in a Victorian script. It was, according to an earlier page in the journal, the copied diagram of an Inuit map for where the Adelaide seal hunters had obtained the ruthenium they oddly called Black Kabluna. Zack matched the contours with a modern map of the islands and identified the targeted spot slightly west of their landing site.
The mine should be a half mile or so down the coastline, he announced after the group had hiked over the ice to a rock-covered beachfront.
Keep your eyes open. Zack marched off down the beach ahead of the geologists, anxious to make the discovery himself. The cold seemed to fade away as he envisioned the potential riches that waited just down the coast. Goyette would already owe him for ridding the Canadian Arctic of American investors. Finding the ruthenium would be frosting on the cake. The rugged shoreline was fronted by an undulating series of gullies and bluffs that climbed toward the island's interior. The ravines were filled with hard-packed ice, while the hilltops were bare, creating a mottled pattern like the dappled coat of a gray mare. Trudging well behind Zack, the geologists moved tentatively in the cold weather, stopping frequently to examine exposed sections of the hillsides and collect samples of rock. Reaching his target area without finding physical evidence of a mine, Zack anxiously paced back and forth until the geologists drew near. "The mine should be in this vicinity," he shouted. "Search the area thoroughly." As the geologists fanned out, the security guard waved Zack over to the edge of the sea ice. Splayed at the man's feet, he found the mutilated carcass of a ringed seal. The mammal's flesh had been torn from its skin in large, jagged chunks. The guard pointed to the animal's skull, where a wide set of claw marks had scratched through the skin. "Only a bear would have left a mark like that," the guard said.
"By the look of the decay, it was a fairly recent meal," Zack replied.
"Keep a sharp lookout, but don't mention this to our scientific friends. They're already distracted enough by the cold." The polar bear never materialized, and, to Zack's dismay, neither did the ruthenium. After an hour of diligent searching, the frozen geologists staggered to Zack with confused looks on their faces.
"The visual results are on par with the south side of the island," said one of the geologists, a bearded man with droopy hazel eyes. "We see some outcrop mineralization with signs of iron, zinc, and a bit of lead content. There's no obvious evidence of platinum group ores, including ruthenium. However, we'll have to assay our samples back on the ship to definitely rule out its presence."
"What about indications of a mine?" Zack asked. The geologists all looked at each other and shook their heads.
"Any mining performed by the Inuit 160 years ago would be by primitive means at best," the lead geologist said. "There would have been evidence of surface disruptions. Unless it is under one of these ice sheets, we didn't see any such indications."
"I see," Zack said in a pallid tone. "All right, back to the ship then. I want to see your assay results as soon as possible."
As they marched across the sea ice to their pickup site, Zack's mind churned in bewilderment. It didn't make sense. The journal was clear that the ruthenium had come from the island. Was it possible that the ore had all played out in a small quantity? Was there a mistake in the journal, or was it all a ruse? As he stood waiting for the Zodiac to arrive, he stared offshore, suddenly spotting a turquoise research ship bearing down on the island. His bewilderment quickly turned to rage.
Chapter 62
Pitt and Jordina were 3 hours into their review of the sonar data when the shipwreck appeared. Jordina had set the viewing speed at double the capture rate, so they were nearly complete with the first grid's results. The rapidly scrolling seabed images had turned the men glassy-eyed, but they both popped out of their seats when the wreck appeared. Jordina immediately hit a keyboard command that froze the image. It was a distinct shadow image of a large wreck sitting upright on the bottom, tilted at just a slight angle. The perimeter of the wreck appeared fully intact, except for a disheveled section running horizontally across the bow. "She's a wooden ship," Pitt remarked, pointing to a trio of long, tapering masts that stretched across the deck and onto the adjacent seafloor. "Looks to have a blunt-shaped bow, characteristic of the bomb ships that the Erebus and Terror were originally built to be." Giordino used the computer's cursor to measure the wreck's dimensions.
"How does 32 meters in length fit?" he asked.
"Like a glove," Pitt replied, flashing a tired smile. "That's got to be one of the Franklin ships." The door to the viewing room burst open, and Dahlgren strode in, carrying a hard drive under his arm.
"Second AUV is back on board, and here's what she's got to say," he declared, handing Jordino the device.
He glanced at the screen, then stared with bulging eyes.
"Shoot, you already found her."
"Mighty fine-looking wreck," he added, nodding at the clear image.
"Half of the pair," Pitt said.
"I'll start getting the submersible prepped. That will make for a sweet dive to the bottom."
Pitt and Jordino finished reviewing the first AUV's imagery, then tore through the data from the second vehicle. The remaining data came up empty, though. The sister shipwreck was somewhere outside the two initial search grids. Pitt decided against expanding the grids until they determined which wreck they had found. He made his way to the bridge with the wreck coordinates, where he found Captain Stenseth gazing out the starboard wing. Less than 2 miles away, the icebreaker Otok came steaming north with its empty barge in tow.
"Lo and behold, a match for one of your friend Goyette's barges," Stenseth remarked.
"A coincidence?" Pitt asked.
"Probably," Stenseth replied. "The barge is riding high, so she's empty. Likely headed for Ellesmere Island for a load of coal, then back through the passage to China."
Pitt studied the vessels as they moved closer, marveling at the massive size of the barge. He stepped over to the chart table and retrieved the photograph Jaeger had provided of the Goyette barge under construction in New Orleans. He looked at the picture and saw it was an exact duplicate of the vessel approaching off the starboard beam.
"We have a match," Pitt remarked. "You think they'll report our position to the Canadian authorities?"
"I doubt it. But there's a chance they're here for the same reason we are." Pitt kept a wary eye on the icebreaker as it steamed past a quarter mile away. There was no friendly chit-chat over the radio, just the silent rocking from the barge's wake as the vessels passed by. Pitt continued to watch as the icebreaker held a steady northbound course.
"Stenseth must be right," he thought. It only made sense that an empty barge in these parts was headed to pick up a shipment, and Ellesmere Island was well to the north of them. Still, there was something uncomfortable about the appearance of the two vessels. Somewhere inside, he knew, it was simply no coincidence.
Chapter 63.
"Her name's the Narwhal. She's Canadian." Zack reached over and snatched the binoculars out of the captain's hands and looked for himself. Studying the research ship, he read her name in white letters across the transom. Peering astern, he found a yellow submersible on the rear deck with Numa painted on the side. He noted with chagrin a maple leaf flag flying atop the bridge.
"A bold move, Mr. Pitt," he muttered.
"That's no Canadian ship, Captain. That is an American research ship operated by Numa."
"How could an American research ship make its way here?"
Zack shook his head. "With some measure of deception, apparently. I have no doubt that they are here after the ruthenium. The fools must think that it is underwater."
He watched the Numa ship fade from view as they continued steaming north.
"Hold our course until we are clear of radar coverage. Stay out of range for an hour or two, then creep back just to the point you can detect them. If they move, then tail them."
He glanced at the bridge clock.
"I'll return shortly before nightfall with our next move."
Zack climbed down a companionway to his cabin, intending to take a nap. Failure was making him irritable, however. The mineral assays for the rocks collected on the North Shore had come back negative for ruthenium, and now there was the presence of the Numa ship. Reaching for a bottle of bourbon, he poured himself a glass but spilled the shot when the ship took a sudden roll. A few drops landed on the Inuit map, which he had set on his nightstand. He grabbed the map, holding it up as a trail of bourbon ran down the page. The liquid bisected the island like a brown river, making it appear to be two separate islands. Zack stared at the map a long while, then hurriedly yanked out a satellite image of the island grouping. Comparing the images of West Island, he matched the south and west coastlines exactly, but not the eastern shoreline. Sliding the Inuit map over, he then compared its shape to the satellite image of East Island. The eastern coastlines matched perfectly, but there the similarities ended.
"You idiot," he muttered to himself. "You're looking in the wrong spot."
The answer was right in front of him. The narrow waterway that had split the West and East Islands had obviously been frozen solid 150 years ago. The Inuit map had actually represented both islands, drawn as one landmass. The difference shifted the position of the ruthenium source nearly 2 miles farther east than he had estimated. Climbing into his bunk, he swallowed the glass of bourbon, then lay down with a renewed sense of hope. All was not lost, for the ruthenium mine must still be there. It had to be. Content in the knowledge, he turned his thoughts to more immediate issues. First, he reasoned, he had to figure out what to do with Pitt and the Numa ship. Chapter 64. The strong westerly winds finally began to abate, reducing the seas to a moderate chop. The settling wind brought with it a wispy gray fog that was common to the region during the spring and summer months. The thermometer finally climbed into double digits, prompting shipboard jokes about the balmy weather. Pitt was just thankful that the weather had calmed enough to launch the submersible without risk. Climbing through the hatch of the Bloodhound, he settled into the pilot seat and began checking a bank of power gauges. Beside him, in the co-pilot seat, Giordino reviewed a pre-dive checklist. Both men wore just light sweaters, shivering in the cold cabin they knew would soon turn toasty from the myriad electrical equipment aboard. Pitt looked up as Jack Dahlgren stuck his poker face into the hatch. "You boys remember, those batteries don't hold their charge so well in this cold weather. Now you go bring me back the ship's bell, and I might just leave the lights on for you."
"You leave the lights on, and I just might let you keep your job," Giordino uttered back.
Dahlgren smiled and started humming the Merle Haggard standard "Okie from Muskogee," then closed and sealed the hatch. A few minutes later, he worked the controls of a small crane, lifting the submersible off the deck and depositing it in the center of the ship's brightly illuminated moon pool. Inside, Pitt signaled for its release, and the yellow cigar-shaped submersible began its descent. The seafloor was just over 1,000 feet deep, and it took the slowly drifting Bloodhound almost 15 minutes to reach to the bottom. The gray-green waters quickly melded to black outside the submersible's large viewing port, but Pitt waited until they passed the 800-foot mark before powering up the bright bank of exterior high-intensity lights. Rubbing his hands together in the slowly warming cabin, Giordino looked at Pitt with mock suffering.
"Did I ever tell you that I'm allergic to the cold?" he asked.
"At least 1,000 times.
My mama's thick Italian blood just doesn't flow right in these icebox conditions."
"I'd say the flow of your blood has more to do with your affinity for cigars and pepperoni pizzas than with your mother."
Giordino gave him a thankful look for the reminder and pulled the stubby remains of an unlit cigar out of his pocket and slid it between his teeth. Then he retrieved a copy of the shipwreck's sonar image and spread it across his lap.
"What's our plan of attack once we reach the wreck site?"
"I figure we have 3 objectives, Pitt replied, having earlier planned the dive. "First and most obvious is to try and identify the wreck. We know that the Erebus had a role in the ruthenium that was obtained by the Inuit. We don't know if the same holds true for the Terror. If the wreck is the Terror, there may well be no clues whatsoever aboard. The second objective is to penetrate the hold and determine if there are any significant quantities of the minerals still there. The third objective is the most tenuous. That would be to search the great cabin and the captain's cabin to determine if the ship's log still exists."
"You're right," Giordino agreed. "The log of the Erebus would be the Holy Grail. It surely would tell us where the ruthenium was found. Sounds like a long shot to hope that it survived intact, though."
"Admittedly, but far from impossible. The log was probably a heavy leather-bound book stored in a chest or locker. In these cold waters, there's at least a chance it's still in one piece. Then it would be up to the preservationists to determine if it could be conserved and ultimately deciphered."
Giordino eyed the depth gauge.
"We're coming up on 950 feet.
"Adjusting for neutral buoyancy," Pitt replied, regulating the submersible's variable ballast tank. Their descent slowed to a crawl as they passed the 1,000-foot mark, and minutes later, a flat, rocky seafloor appeared beneath them. Pitt engaged the propulsion controls and drove the vessel forward, skimming a few feet off the bottom. The craggy brown seafloor was mostly devoid of life, a cold and empty world not far removed from the frozen lands protruding above the surface. Pitt turned the submersible into the current, guiding the vessel in a sweeping series of S-turns. Though the narwhal had been stationed directly above the wreck, Pitt knew that they had drifted considerably south during their descent. Jordina was the first to spot the wreck, pointing out a dark shadow on their starboard flank. Pitt steered the Bloodhound hard to the right until the stately wreck materialized under their spotlights. Before them sat a fully intact 19th-century wooden sailing ship. It was one of the most remarkable shipwrecks Pitt had ever seen. The frigid Arctic waters had retained the ship's condition in a near-perfect state of preservation. Covered in a fine layer of silt, the ship appeared fully intact, from its bowsprit to its rudder. Only the masts, which had slipped from the deck during the long plunge to the bottom, lay out of place, dangling over the side railing. Mired in its desolate eternal mooring, the ancient ship exuded a forlorn aura. To Pitt, the ship appeared like a tomb in an empty graveyard. He felt an odd chill thinking about the men who had sailed her, then been forced to abandon their home of 3 years under desperate conditions. Slowly engaging the submersible, Pitt cruised in a tight arc around the vessel while Giordino activated a forward-mounted video camera. The hull timbers still appeared thick and sound, and in places where the silt was thin, they could see a coat of black paint still adhering to the wood. As they rounded the stern, Giordino was startled to see the tips of a propeller protruding from the sand. "They had steam power?" he asked. "A supplement to sail, once they reached the ice pack," Pitt confirmed. Both ships were equipped with coal-fired locomotive engines installed for added propulsion through the thinner sea ice. The steam engines were also used to provide heat for the ship's interior. No wonder Franklin had the confidence to try to plow through Victoria Strait in late summer. What he may not have had enough of by that point in the expedition was coal. Some figure they ran short of their coal supplies, and that may have accounted for the ship's becoming trapped in the ice. Pitt pushed the submersible around to the ship's port side, anxious to find lettering on the bow that might reveal the ship's name. But he was disappointed to find instead the only real evidence of damage to the ship. The hull beneath the bow was blown out in a jagged mass of timbers caused by the constricting ice. The damage had extended to the topside deck when the weakened section had struck the seafloor, causing the timbers above to buckle. A broad section of the bow on both sides of the center line had crumpled like an accordion just a few feet astern of the vessel's blunt prow. Pitt patiently hovered off both sides of the bow as Giordino brushed aside the silt with an articulated arm, but no identifying script work could be found. "I guess this one wants to play hard to get," Pitt muttered. "Like too many of the women I've dated," Giordino grimaced. "I guess we'll have to take Dahlgren up on his ship's bell offer after all." Pitt elevated the submersible above the deck, then swept toward the stern. The deck was remarkably clear of debris, the ship obviously configured in its winter hibernation mode when it was abandoned. The only unusual item was a large canvas structure that lay across the deck amidships. Pitt knew from the historical accounts that a tent-like covered structure was set up on the deck in winter so that the crew could escape the interior confines of the ship for exercise. Pitt continued aft, where he found the helmsman's station and the large wooden ship's wheel, still standing upright and attached to the rudder. A small bell was mounted nearby, but after careful scrutiny, he could find no markings on it. "I know where the ship's bell is," Pitt stated, cruising back toward the bow. Hovering over the tangled mass of timbers and debris where the bow had buckled, he pointed down. "It's in the garbage pit here." "Must be," Giordino agreed with a nod. "It's not our day. Or night." He checked a console of dials in front of him. "We have just under 4 hours of battery power remaining. Do you want to rummage around for the bell or have a look inside?" "Let's take Rover for a walk. There's one upside to this damage, I suppose. It will allow us easier access to the interior." Pitt edged the Bloodhound to a clear section of the deck, then carefully set the submersible down. When the ship's timbers gave no indication of stress, he powered off the propulsion motors. In the co-pilot seat, Giordino was busy engaging another device. Tucked between the submersible's support skids was a small tethered ROV the size of a small suitcase. Equipped with a micro-sized video camera and small array of lights, it could maneuver into the smallest corners of the shipwreck.
Jockeying a controlling joystick, Giordino guided the rover out from its cradle and toward the open section of the deck. Pitt flipped down an overhead monitor, which displayed the live video feed from the device. Methodically weaving above and around the debris, Giordino finally found a large gap in the deck and guided the ROV into the bowels of the ship. Pitt unrolled a cutaway diagram of the Erebus and tried to track the ROV's location as it moved beneath the main deck. The ship had two levels below decks, plus a dank hold where the engine, boiler, and coal reserves were housed below the waterline. The living and dining areas for both crew and officers were located on the lower deck, one level down from the main deck. Beneath the lower deck was the orlop deck, which was strictly a storage area for provisions, tools, and ship's spares. "You should be dropping near the galley," Pitt remarked. "It's adjacent to the crew's living quarters, which is a sizable compartment." Giordino guided the rover down until the deck came into view, then he turned and panned the bay. The still water inside the ship was exceedingly translucent, providing perfectly clear visibility. Pitt and Giordino could see, not 5 feet away from the ROV, the galley's large cook stove, built up on a layer of bricks. It was a massive structure made of cast iron and crowned by 6 large burners on its flat cooking surface. Sitting atop it were several black iron pots of varying sizes. "One galley as ordered," Giordino remarked. He then steered the ROV aft, slowly scanning back and forth. The thin bulkhead surrounding the galley had fallen to the deck, revealing the open crew's quarters. The bay was mostly empty of debris, save for a large number of planked wooden slabs that lay evenly spaced across the deck. "Mess tables," Pitt explained as the rover's cameras focused in on one of the tabletops. They were stowed overhead to make way for the crew's hammocks, but lowered on ropes at mealtimes. They've fallen to the deck as the ropes deteriorated. The ROV moved aft as the compartment narrowed until fronting a wide bulkhead. "That will be the main hatchway," Pitt explained. "Keep moving aft and we should reach a ladderway that descends to the orlop deck. They covered it with an enclosure to keep out the draft from below, but we'll have to hope it was dislodged when the ship sank." Giordino steered the ROV around the hatchway, then brought it to a sudden halt. Tilting it toward the deck, the camera revealed a large circular hole cut through the deck. "No door here," he said. "Of course we can drop through the deck collar," Pitt replied. The deck collar held one of the ship's 3 masts as it ran down to the hold. When the masts pulled free during the sinking, they left an open passageway into the lowest depths of the ship. The rover squeezed through the opening, then sprayed its lights on the black orlop deck. For the next 50 minutes, the ROV scoured the corners of the deck, Giordino methodically searching for possible traces of the ore. But all they found was a vast supply of tools, weapons, and the ship's stowed canvas sails that would never feel a sea breeze again. Returning to the mast stand, they delved into the lower hold, finding only a few scraps of coal near the massive steam boiler. Coming up empty on both levels, Giordino began threading the ROV back up to the lower deck when the submersible's radio crackled. "Narwhal the Bloodhound, have you got your ears on?" came the readily distinguishable voice of Jack Dahlgren. "Bloodhound here. Go ahead, Jack," Pitt replied. "The captain wanted me to let you know that our friend with the barge has moseyed back onto the radar screen. Appears to be sitting stationary about 10 miles north of us."
"Affirmative. Please keep us advised."
"Will do. You boys having any luck down there?"
"We sure are, but it has all been bad. We've got Rover on the leash and are about to try for the captain's cabin."
"How are you doing on power?"
Pitt eyed a bank of dials and meters overhead. "We're good for another 90 minutes on the bottom, and we'll probably need it all."
"Roger. We'll look for you up top in less than 2. Narwhal out."
Pitt stared at the dark abyss beyond the submersible, contemplating the icebreaker on the surface above. Were they, in fact, monitoring the narwhal? His gut told him so with certainty. It wouldn't be his first encounter with the forces of Mitchell Goyette, he now knew. And what of Clay Zack? Could it be possible that Goyette's thug was aboard the icebreaker? Giordino nudged him back to the task at hand.
"Ready to move aft."
The clock is ticking, Pitt said quietly. Let's get it done. Chapter 65. A dense, icy fog crept across the Otak as dusk settled over Victoria Strait. The Narwhal was long lost from physical view, and Zack searched for her on the radar scope, finding the research ship as a narrow smudge on the top of the screen. Across the bridge, the icebreaker's captain paced back and forth, having grown bored with holding his ship stationary for the past few hours. But the captain saw no signs of boredom in Zack's face. On the contrary, there was an odd intensity about him. Like in the moment before an assassination, he was fully alert, his senses in high gear. While he had murdered many times before, he had never done so on a large scale. It was a test of cunning, he liked to think, that made his blood run fast. It gave him a sensation of invincibility, inflated by the knowledge that he had always come out on top. Bring us to within 8 kilometers of the Narwhal, he finally directed the captain, and do so nice and easy. The captain engaged the helm and brought the ship and attached barge around on a southerly heading. Aided by the swift-moving current, the icebreaker ran just above idle, covering the distance in less than an hour. Reaching the new position, the captain swung his bow around to the current in order to remain stationary. 8 kilometers and holding, he reported to Zack. Zack eyed the gloomy darkness outside the bridge window and creased his lips in satisfaction. Prepare to release the barge at my command, he said. The captain stared at him as if he were insane. What are you saying? He asked. You heard me. We are going to release the barge. That's a $10 million vessel. In this fog and current, there's no way we'll be able to tie back up to her. She'll rip her hull open on some ice or run aground on the islands. Either way, Mr. Goyette will have my head. Zack shook his head with a thin smile. She won't be traveling very far. As for Goyette, please recall the signed letter I gave you in Kugluktuk, giving me complete authority while I'm aboard this ship. Believe me, he will consider it a small price to pay to eliminate a problem that could cost him hundreds of millions of dollars. Besides, he added with a conniving grin, isn't that what marine insurance is for? The captain reluctantly ordered his deckhands to the stern of the ship to man the tow lines. The men waited in the cold while Zack ran down to his cabin, then returned to the bridge carrying his leather satchel. At Zack's command, the captain reversed power and backed down on the barge until the thick tow lines fell slack in the water. The deckhands released a lock plate, then heaved the looped ends of the tow lines up and off the stern bollards. The men watched morbidly as the lines slid down the stern and disappeared into the black water below. When the bridge received an all-clear signal, the captain pulled the ship forward, then came around the barge's starboard flank at Zack's urging. The dark mass of the barge could barely be seen a few yards away as the fog continued to thicken. Zack reached into his satchel and pulled out a high-frequency radio transmitter, then stepped out onto the bridge wing. Extending a small antenna, he powered on the device and immediately pushed a red transmit button. The radio signal only had to travel a short distance to trigger the detonator cap planted on the stern of the barge. Less than a second later, the dynamite charge ignited. The explosion was neither loud nor visually impressive, just a resounding pop that reverberated within the barge, followed by a light puff of smoke that rose from the rear deck. Zack observed the scene for just a few seconds, then returned to the warmth of the bridge, replacing the transmitter into his bag. I don't like having the blood of those men on my hands, the captain grumbled. But you have it all wrong, Captain. The loss of the barge was quite accidental. The captain simply stared at Zack with a look of dismay. It's very simple, Zack continued. You shall write in your log and report to the authorities back in port that the American research ship inadvertently collided with our barge in the fog and both vessels sank. We, of course, were most fortunate to release the tow lines in the nick of time and suffered no casualties. Regrettably,
We were unable to find any survivors in the water from the Numa ship.
But the Numa ship has not sunk, the captain protested.
That, Zack replied with a snarl, is about to change.
Chapter 66. 1,000 feet below the surface, the intervening hour had been one of complete frustration for Pitt and Giordino. While guiding the rover aft along the lower deck, Giordino watched as the ROV jerked to a standstill and refused to move forward. Retracing its trail of cable, he found the power cord had become tangled in some debris at the head of the galley. Matters only got worse when the ROV's thrusters kicked up a huge cloud of silt around the snagged area. He had to wait 10 minutes just for the visibility to return before he could see enough to free the cable. The interior of the submersible had finally grown hot, and sweat dribbled down Giordino's face as he tensely guided the ROV back through the crew's quarters and down the main passageway toward the stern of the ship.
"Where's the lounge on this boat? I think Rover and I could both use a cold beer about now," he muttered.
"You would have needed to break into the spirit room below decks where the rum was stored. Of course, if this is the Erebus, then you might be out of luck, as Franklin was a teetotaler."
"That seals it," Giordino said. "No further proof required. My present state of luck dictates that this has to be the Erebus."
Despite the minutes ticking down on their bottom time, neither man was ready to give up. They pressed the ROV onward, striking down the single aft passageway, past the cramped officers' cabins, until finally arriving at a large compartment at the very stern of the ship. Called the Great Cabin, it stretched from beam to beam, offering the one truly comfortable haven for the men of the ship, or at least its officers. Stocked with a library, chess sets, playing cards, and other sources of entertainment, it was also a potential repository for the ship's log. But like the rest of the vessel, the Great Cabin offered no clues to the ship's identity. Scattered across the deck and around an upturned table was a knee-deep pile of books. Lined on wide shelves across each side of the cabin, the large collection of books had smashed through the glass cases during the sinking and been strewn everywhere. Giordino slowly flew the ROV back and forth across the cabin, surveying the wall-to-wall mess.
"Looks like the San Francisco Library after the great earthquake," Giordino said.
"The ship's library contained 1,200 volumes, Pitt replied, studying the mess with disappointment. "If the ship's log is buried in there, it will take a couple of fortnights and a good rabbit's foot to find it." Their frustration was interrupted by another radio transmission from Dahlgren.
"Sorry to break up the fiesta, but the big hand on the clock says it's time for you to begin your ascent," he said.
"We'll be on our way shortly," Pitt replied.
"Fair enough. The captain says to tell you that our shadow is closed to within 4 miles and is sitting pretty again. I think the captain would feel a whole lot better if you boys got yourselves aboard pronto."
"Understood. Bloodhound out." Giordino looked at Pitt and noticed a look of concern in his green eyes.
"You think that pal of yours from the miners' co-op is aboard the icebreaker?"
"I'm beginning to wonder," Pitt replied.
"Let's try the captain's cabin and then we'll skedaddle."
The captain's cabin was located off the far side of the Great Cabin and represented a faint hope for containing the ship's log. But a small sliding door to the cabin was locked, and no amount of bumping or cajoling by the ROV would shake it loose. With less than an hour of battery power left and a 20-minute ride to the surface, Pitt called the survey off and told Giordino to fetch Rover back home. Giordino steered the ROV back to the galley and toward the entry gap in the bow as a take-up spool reeled in the power cable. Pitt powered up the submersible's thrusters, then gazed out the viewport at the Bloodhound's electronic pod while waiting for the ROV.
"How did the mineral sensor test out?" he asked, pointing at the pod.
"Seems to work like a champ," Giordino replied, his eyes glued to the overhead monitor as he threaded the ROV through the forward debris. "We won't be able to gauge its full accuracy until we assay our samples back at headquarters."
Pitt reached over and powered on the sensor, watching a nearby monitor as it computed the mineral readings. Of no surprise to Pitt, the screen registered a very large iron concentration nearby, along with some trace elements of copper and zinc.
The iron made perfect sense, as the ship was loaded with it, from the anchors and anchor chains directly below them to the locomotive engine in the hold. But it was one of the other trace elements that caught his eye. Waiting until the ROV snaked out of the lower deck, he engaged the thrusters and elevated the submersible. Moving slowly, he brought the craft to a hover over the damaged section of the bow while keeping one eye on the sensor's output.
"If you can find us some gold on this tub, it would redeem an otherwise forgettable dive," Giordino said.
Pitt danced the submersible over the debris area, gradually focusing on a small section near the ship's center line. Easing to a stable section of the